Morning, you may take your seats. Take a brief second to get settled here. All right, good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're hearing cases today from the Olmsted County Government Center in Rochester. We often hear appeals from the Minnesota Judicial Center in St. Paul, but we periodically travel to hear cases in other courthouses around the state to ensure better access to our court. We appreciate the warm welcome and hospitality of the district court staff. For the audio record, today is May 8th, 2025. Today's argument is being live streamed, and we're also making an audio recording, which will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. Just a brief reminder that no other recordings are permitted without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. We have five cases on our calendar today. We'll hear the first three cases and then take a 15-minute recess and return for the final two cases. So with that, I'll go ahead and call the first case, which is A24-1251, State of Minnesota versus Kenneth Tyler Ashon. Good morning, counsel. Good
morning, Your Honor.
You'll each be given 15 minutes for argument this morning, and then appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please, before you begin, feel free to make yourself comfortable at the podium and then identify yourself and your client for the record. And make sure you can see the time clocks on the side next to the deputy here. Great. Please go ahead.
My name is Charles Clifford, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Kenneth Ashon. Mr. Ashon was convicted of being a prohibited person in possession of a firearm. The facts are relatively simple. He was there was a disturbance here in Rochester. The police were called out to investigate. They found a gun, and he admitted the gun was his. So typically, there's a bigger argument about whether there's actual possession of the gun versus the prohibition. Here, the issue is about the prohibition and how it should be determined by a fact finder. And in particular, Mr. Ashon is convicted of a domestic-related offense out of Iowa. And the state had the burden of proving whether that offense would have been a crime of violence had it been committed here in Minnesota. And that was the first issue. The second issue, again, was how the fact finder was to determine whether this was a crime of violence. And it's actually got kind of an interesting conflict of cases here because the state relies on Martin for an elements examination of the case. And I'm arguing at Shepherd that there needs to be more than just a comparison of the elements. There's got to be some additional fact finding so that there can be some determination that this would have been a crime of violence had it been committed.
What facts would you have us say should have been submitted to a jury?
Well, Shepherd would require some sort of judicial acknowledgement of the...
No, I understand the case law, but in this situation, what question would be submitted to the jury for resolution?
Your Honor, it's interesting. I chatted with a couple of colleagues about this yesterday. It's, typically criminal defendants stipulate to their prior conviction, so it's nothing that has to get to the jury. But there would have to be some kind of record of his conviction that would have to be submitted to the jury.
So are you disputing that there actually was a conviction in Iowa? I mean, is that the... Because I don't see that in the briefing anyplace. So what would be the charge to the jury? What would be the, jury, you need to decide this. And what's the this?
You need to decide whether this would have been a crime of violence had it been committed in Minnesota.
Isn't that a question of law, though?
No, it's not. It's a question of fact. And, you know,
I mean, maybe I should have asked the question in a little more nuanced way. When the court's comparison of the statutory elements, that seems to me to be a question of law. And then whether his conduct qualifies, it seems to be a question of fact. Have I drawn the line correctly, or is there a different place that the line should be drawn?
No, I largely agree with that. I think the court has to make an initial determination as to whether this is would have been a crime of violence had it happened in Minnesota, but it's ultimately a question for the jury to decide that fact too. And actually, it's
that fact too. I mean, when I look at the district court's order, the first sentence in the legal analysis says the sole issue before the court is whether a conviction for domestic assault strangulation under Iowa law is a crime of violence under Minnesota law. Is that a question of law, or is framed exactly that way? Is that a question of, regardless of what the district court did later in the order,
right,
is that a question of law, or is that a question of fact?
I think initially it's a question of law, but I think it's a mixed question of law and fact in the end. And when I was discussing this with a couple of colleagues, it was take this Iowa nimble out of this case. Had he gone to trial, there still would have, he was entitled to a jury determination of whether he was convicted of a crime of violence.
And then if the last paragraph of the district court's order before the conclusion were not present, if it were omitted, here when reading the statute side by side, the two are nearly identical, and then the conclusion says the defendant's conviction would have been a crime, that part of it, those pieces were omitted from the order, would there be an, would you still have an issue with what the district court did?
I'm sorry, on page 4 of the court's order?
Yeah. In conclusion, the court finds the defendant's conviction in Iowa, like that part of it. I mean, it seems like everything up to that point are decisions of law, and then that part of the district court's order applying the law to this particular case is the thing that you're taking exception to, if I can just sort of cabin the argument.
Well, I guess the paragraph right up before, it says the facts of the defendant's Iowa conviction show a relationship.
Yep.
That, and I think that's...
That's the problem.
That's a problem.
Okay.
Because that's the judge making a fact finding that should have gone to the jury.
All right. I understand the argument. Thank you.
Yeah. And actually, what's interesting about that finding of fact is that I only found that one place, and it's in a police report where the officer makes the arrest and says, you lose here and they have a child together. There's no basis for why the police officer know that or what's going on. So
if the Iowa statute was identical in wording to Minnesota statute, would there still be a jury issue?
Yes.
So if it was a prior Minnesota conviction, the burden on the state is still to prove to the jury that there was a conviction. Doesn't matter, the in-state, out-of-state, you're saying anytime.
Anytime.
Unless there's a stipulation.
Right. And that's why we have all the law about criminal defendants personally stipulating to an element of the offense when they do those waivers, because it's an element of the offense. And
then at trial, would a defendant be able to collaterally attack the conviction, the validity of the conviction?
I think it would depend on what's on the conviction on what's submitted. Say the conviction, it's me, my middle name is misspelled. I think I would be able to say that's not me, but there's something wrong in the document. Is it a winning argument? Maybe not, but I think it's still something that, you know, the government would have to prove up the factual basis or the foundation for the conviction.
But so how is this, you in your letter of supplemental authority, you pointed us to the Erlinger case, which as I understand it, you know, would support the point that the jury, because this would somehow enhance a sentence or cause a different, you know, penalty, that the jury would have to find the fact of conviction. But isn't that the exception that at least the U.S. Supreme Court carved out in the Almendarez-Torres case? So why isn't this just the fact that it's proving a fact of conviction, and that's what the court is doing as a legal matter by preponderance of evidence?
And actually, I'm gonna call that case Erlinger because I had a professor named Erlinger. I think it's Erslinger.
Oh, you've,
yeah, the supplemental authority. Yes.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
They worked pretty hard to distinguish the unlawful immigration cases. I can't remember the name of it right now. It's But it's the issue about the prior conviction. Mm-hmm. And they really limited that holding to immigration situations where the person had been deported, there was a conviction for an unlawful deportation, and comes back in because he gets a sentencing enhancement for that in the federal system. And so the very, very much limited the holding in that case to an immigration conviction. And it was very clear. I mean, there's great language in that case about the requirement of a jury trial, and any fact that increases the sentence has to be found by a jury. And it here, you know, again, the conviction is a fact that would have to be found by a jury. You can't direct a verdict on that element.
Do you have a Minnesota case that says that?
I cited in my brief. It's the a great bodily harm with the tooth. And I can grab that site for you if you want. When I come back,
thank you.
But that was a case where the court directed a verdict on the great bodily harm issue rather than submitting it to a jury, and that was error. And
I think it's Moore, right? State v. Moore, I think.
Yes.
So separating out the omnibus ruling. The court ruled on that and said, I think this is similar enough. I'm not going to dismiss this complaint or this charge count. With then you get to a trial. So at trial, and it was submitted to the court on stipulated facts. So the court was then determining the question that there was this prior conviction in the ultimate trial ruling. So why doesn't that satisfy your Apprendi argument?
Because I think it was a stipulated facts trial to preserve the issues for an appeal, including the ruling that the court said.
But you didn't have a ruling on the guilt or acquittal at that point. So all you had was the district court's ruling that I'm not going to dismiss this because I think this is equivalent. Aren't you kind of conjoining the two together?
Well, yeah.
I mean, because the court, you didn't, the court, there was no determination on guilt or not guilty of the complaint until the trial.
On the hearing on 11/27, we read that transcript.
Right.
It's a fairly long discussion about whether the conviction is going to get submitted to the jury. And the court said, I am not going to allow that to go back.
And the motion in limine.
Yes.
Okay.
So there's an adverse ruling saying, no, that I have decided this is a matter of law, that this is a crime of violence, and the jury is going to be told that. So there is.
Did the district court preclude you or your predecessor from submitting evidence that he didn't actually commit the crime for which he was committed or he was convicted? I mean, that's sort of the nuance that I was getting at before. I don't remember that ruling, but I could have missed it.
Yes, I mean, there was a limiting ruling saying, I say the matter of law, and the jury is not going to decide whether he has this prior conviction as a crime of violence. I can't remember the exact ruling, but that's what sets off the stipulated facts trial, because I think defense lawyers like, well, it's a crime of violence, the jury's going to, you know, been told that it is a matter of law. There was not much left to litigate at that stage.
Yeah, you or your predecessor, I should say, construed that ruling as I'm not going to be able to challenge this conviction in any way.
Right.
So if we were to agree with the district court that this would be a felony in Minnesota, the Iowa conviction, could we say, well, then, to the extent the district court erred in the motion in limine, that it's a harmless error?
I don't know that we need to direct a verdict on an element of the offense. I don't think that could be a harmless error. I mean, you're pulling that up.
You're saying so it's a constitutional violation of a right to have it determined?
So I would hope that court doesn't do that. I think we've covered all the territory I was prepared to cover. I can get the court the site for my quick break here. But if there's no other question, we just ask the court reverse Mr. Sean's conviction.
So you would distinguish Almendarez Torres?
Yes, thank you.
I'm not sure that's exactly the right pronunciation. How? Because that doesn't mean that the ultimate question of whether he had this prior conviction for a crime of violence is an element of the crime, that it doesn't relate to that part of it. I mean, how do you distinguish that? Because that's still, even though in Erlinger the Supreme Court said, oh, shade cast all over this, but they didn't overrule it, so it's still good law.
But again, the Supreme Court very much restricted that Menendez case to a situation where a prior deportation. I think they wanted to overrule it, but they didn't. So, and again, I think there's a difference too. Especially, you know, the ruling in Apprendi, any fact other than a prior conviction that enhances a sentence, so that maybe more in line with Apprendi, but this is not just a prior conviction. This has got to be a specific crime of violence that, had it happened in Minnesota, would have been a crime of violence. So I think it's more, and I think in Shepherd they talk about the facts. Some prior convictions are more important than just the fact of the prior conviction. So, thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Excuse me. My name is Jim Haas, and I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. I'd like to focus initially on the second aspect of the appellant's argument with respect to the Sixth Amendment in this case. On page 15 of my brief, I quoted from the standard criminal jury instructions on this charge. We use this routinely as a standard instruction. We do it all the time. And the elements are this. First, the defendant knowingly possessed a firearm. Second, the defendant had been convicted in this state or elsewhere for committing a crime of violence. That's the question of fact for the jury. Instruction continues, says, you are instructed that, and in the standard jury instruction, there's a bracket. I filled in the Iowa statute here. You are instructed that Iowa Code section 708.2A subdivision 5 and bracket is a crime of violence. That's the distinction here.
Well, I don't think that given the district court's order that instruction, which is not law, as you know, would have actually been given, because the last paragraph of the district court's order says the court finds, not the jury, that defendant's conviction in Iowa would have been a crime if committed in Minnesota, and also says that the facts of the defendant's underlying the defendant's conviction would have been a crime. So there's nothing left for the jury to find given the court's order. That's their argument. What's your response to that?
Well, on page 16 of my brief, I cited the case of State versus Wisco, which, by the way, originated right here in Winfield County. And I'll confess, I think I did a poor job of really framing up the holding of Wisco. And as I look back on it, I'd like to do that here this morning, because I think that really is dispositive of that issue. And I think it also helps then inform us as we look at the first issue. Kane Wisco was charged with a first-degree aggravated robbery, and the state sought to enhance his sentence under 609.1095, which requires the fact finder, the jury in this case, to determine that he was a risk to public safety. And then the statute says, but the court determines if he has two violent crimes as defined by the statute. The jury found him guilty of the elements, and the jury found that he was a risk to public safety. And the district court found that he had two violent crimes as defined in 1095. One of those was a Wisconsin burglary. And that led to, but there was, so there's two kind of holdings in Wisco that this court made that I think are important. The question presented primarily was, may a district court determine whether an out-of-state conviction is for a violent crime under 609.1095 without violating a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial? So that was really the square, the question squarely presented. It was in a sentencing context, but it's the same right and the same principle. And this court determined that a district court may constitutionally determine whether an out-of-state conviction is for a violent crime when sentencing under Section 609.1095, so long as the district court's determination is limited to the elements of the conviction of offense and plea admissions regarding those elements.
Isn't that distinguished from what happened here? I mean, it does seem like in the district court's order, it's going beyond an examination of just the elements of the two statutes and instead delving into the facts that underlie the conviction in Iowa to determine whether what actually happened there allegedly constitutes a crime of violence in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And doesn't that impede, and this, you know, relatedly, doesn't that impede on the province of the jury?
Well, I think what this court said in Wisco and related cases, there's a term that's come to about called Shepherd documents relating to the Supreme Court case in Shepherd. And it's, these are the documents pertinent to the crime itself of this condition. That would be the charging document, maybe a plea petition, plea colloquy transcript, the record of conviction itself. And what I think what the cases here sort of collectively say that the district court, in determining the legal character of that case, can examine those documents, those court records, because they flow from a process that where a person's been convicted beyond reasonable doubt. There's a discussion of that in the Wisco case. And again, I should have spent more time with that in my brief, but I think it's important.
Is there a distinction between looking at those documents and then the court making findings of fact about what had occurred?
Well, I think those limited findings are permissible in the case law, again, so that they're contained within those documents. So
and what's your best authority for that proposition?
Well, I think Wisco states that.
Okay.
At least for Minnesota law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even this, the Erlinger case they talked about, in Erlinger, the question was to enhance the sentence, the person had to be convicted of these offenses on diverse occasions, on different, distinctly different occasions. That fact, whether they occurred on different occasions, that was a question of fact for fact finder. But the legal character and nature of the offenses, well, was not. So that's, I think, the distinguishing fact from Erlinger and other cases cited here. Well, but in our case, of course, we have a charging document and, of course, the record of conviction. And in the district court's order, the omnibus order, it made reference to that because the allegation, at least for this offense, is that the complainant said that Mr. Ashan choked her with his hands for long enough. She felt as though she was going to pass out, and that he was that he and this complainant had a child together. So there was that domestic relationship. And the court's permitted to examine these charging documents that are associated with the conviction. And then, of course, we have the record of the conviction indicating that he was found guilty of that offense. So the, I think the district court here, the omnibus hearing, properly considered the submitted court records.
Did the district court, though, need to? I mean, isn't it just looking at the two statutes? Isn't that the proper inquiry?
Well, certainly that is. And I think that may just be dispositive. I mean, the district court said, how could you conceivably be guilty of this Iowa offense at least under the circumstances alleged here, without committing the same comparable offense in Minnesota. So I don't disagree with the court in that regard. But the seems like the inquiry here has been, is there some fact-finding permissible within this? And I think there is. That is, the court can look to charging documents. They can look to a plea colloquy. They could look to, for example, a Rule 15 petition. Now, what is the person pleading guilty to? And then ultimately, is the record, the judgment of conviction, which identifies the proper statute. The problem there was in the Wisco case, as you may recall, was that Wisco, Wisconsin burglary, he was charged under two different provisions of Wisconsin burglary statute. One had an element of a dangerous weapon possession. The other didn't. Well, as it turns out, Wisco's crime of conviction was for the burglary that just said, I went into the building and I committed a theft, for example. But in his pre-sentence investigation, it laid out the facts where, in fact, he actually broke into a business and stole two firearms. So he did possess it. And where the district court erred in Wisco is that it considered the pre-sent an assertion of fact in the pre-sentence investigation in that case that was talking about the Wisconsin case. And that was beyond the scope of the documents that the district court was permitted to look to when discerning the legal character of the offense.
So I guess this, I keep coming back to, and I think this is along the lines of what Judge Siegel was asking. So in the Martin case, my understanding was that if we apply that test, we look only at the elements and we look at whether proving the elements of the out-of-state offense would necessarily prove a violation of Minnesota law, meaning that there could be a situation where an out-of-state conviction, you could be convicted for something that would also violate Minnesota law, but maybe would not. And regardless of the facts of what happened in that particular case, we only look to whether it necessarily would violate Minnesota law. And if that's the case, then some of this fact-finding, and I think it's a different question from what you're talking about with the example you said, what Wisconsin is, there's a question about which statute was he at, or which, you know, different kind of offense was, did he actually commit that would constitute a conviction in that case? And like that there's those comparison to try and figure out which one it was. That didn't happen here. Here we just have a straight up conviction without those different ways of violating the statute. So why isn't it that we just look at the elements? And here it seems to come down to the word intentionally and knowingly. And if knowingly is exactly the same or means intentionally in all cases necessarily, then it's a prior conviction that's a crime of violence. But if there are examples of facts where knowingly could be something less than intentionally, then it's not. Full stop. We don't get to look and see whether he actually had intent. That's how I was understanding Martin. So I'm still just now confused. And maybe it's.
Well, whatever. I don't disagree. We are two kind of distinctly different arguments. And of course, as I mentioned, I agree, by the way, from the state's position, is the intention here was to do a stipulated trial or a dispositive pretrial order, which we believe to be the omnibus order. And under that rule 2601 subdivision 4, the intention there is that. That pretrial dispositive order is negates whether we need to have a trial or not. We felt that that was the sole issue. In other words, this aspect of the whether a jury gets to determine that, our position was that was really beyond the scope. If he's eligible to possess a firearm, the whole thing is done, right? That was the only disputed fact, and it was resolved. So that's one aspect. So I don't disagree. I think the Martin analysis really just focuses on the omnibus hearing. And when you hold those statutes that the only discernible difference in the appellant's argument was this issue of knowingly versus intentionally. And I think the district court correctly found them to be indistinguishable for this purpose under these statutes. And I think our position is correctly found that this Iowa statute, if committed in Minnesota, would be a crime of violence. I do think the district court can and may also look to the context of the charging document, what was alleged, what was charged, as it provides that context to, again, ensure that this is the, you know, the same thing. But I argument is that the elements are legally indistinguishable.
So was there any ruling by the district court that the issue of whether Ashan, is that correctly pronounced, had wasn't an ineligible person? I mean, that he committed, was convicted of a crime of violence. Was there any definitive ruling by the district court that I'm going to decide that before trial?
Well, our position is that's what the omnibus court did. That Judge Haynes' ruling and omnibus was, yep, as a matter of law, that's a crime of violence. And that's what dovetails into the jury instruction. You know, the jury asks, hey, does he have a conviction?
And then, so the jury would still decide whether there was a conviction.
That's right.
And would be instructed as a matter of law that this statute qualifies.
In other words, we don't ask jurors to do statutory analysis. We don't give them two statutes and say, hold these statutes up to the light and decide whether, for example, are they a felon?
So that's a question of law then. Whether this statute is the same as that statute, not, which is different from establishing the element of a crime.
And again, you know, it maybe gets a little, these aren't necessarily difficult elements to prove. They're generally not in dispute, but nevertheless, the state has burden of proof. And if we don't meet that burden, you know, it's an element. No one disputed he had a conviction, but still the state has to come forward with evidence unless they stipulate to. Now they did here in the sense that it was a stipulated evidence trial from our perspective to get appellate review of that omnibus ruling. But again, the state has to present evidence of the conviction, but the court does the legal work and informs the jury as to the character. In other words, so they don't have to deliberate about that. So,
can I ask you, I have one more question just about the meaning in Minnesota of the word intentionally. I don't know if you have the statute in front of you, but as I read it, it has two parts to what it means to do something intentionally. This is at Minnesota Statute 60902, subdivision 9.3. It says that the actor either has a purpose to do the thing or cause the result specified or believes that the act performed by the actor, if successful, will cause that result. And this is the and is what I'm interested in, the actor must have knowledge of those facts which are necessary to make the actor's conduct criminal and which are set forth after the word intentionally, which here I think would be strangulation, intentionally impeding normal breathing or circulation of the blood by applying pressure. So what do you make of that two-part definition that we have, like, you know, you have a purpose to cause a result and you know of the facts that are necessary, which here are that you're impeding normal breathing or circulation. Is that means that there's something different between knowing something and intending it?
Well, I think that this, may I
answer? Please.
I think that distinguishes the criminal act from, say, an accidental, unintentional act. They didn't, maybe I didn't realize I was doing it. Wasn't knowing, but I had no idea that I was choking you in this movement that I was making. That wasn't my intention, or I didn't realize I was doing it, for example. No, there has to be some knowledge of what you're doing. And I guess.
But isn't that what the Iowa statute says?
I guess in a nutshell, Your Honor, I just find them indistinguishable for this purpose, as do the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge, I'm going to just follow where you were asking, Judge Bentley, because I agree. I think there is a difference in the mens rea requirement in between the Iowa statute and the Minnesota statute. And it just based on the plain language of the statute, it says, in addition, except as provided in clause, the actor must have knowledge of the knowing requirement. So the intentional the definition of intentional in Minnesota is narrower than the knowing definition of Iowa, and that's why the Martin elements comparison fails. That's why I think the district court's omnibus order was wrong. Ultimately, Your Honor, I just wanted to pick up on that point, and if there's no other questions, we just ask the court to reverse.
How do you distinguish State v. Outlaw?
If I remember Outlaw,
that's a opinion holding that it does not violate the right to jury for a court to determine whether an out-of-state conviction is a felony under Minnesota law. It's about an aggravating five prior felonies, and you can impose an aggravated sentence.
Sure. And I think, if I remember right, in Outlaw, there was a discussion about the Shepherd documents that had come up, that there were some judicial admissions and other evidence that had been admitted not offensive to the Sixth Amendment for the district court to make that finding. But here we don't have a plea petition, we don't have a plea transcript, we don't have any of that, which would, I think, commonly come in as the Shepherd document. All we have is the allegation and the police report, which is, if we're looking at acceptable documents, the allegation of the police report is pretty far away from the realm of acceptable Shepherd documents. So if there's no other questions, can we just ask the court to reverse it?
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your argument this morning. The case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the time prescribed by statute.